Dr. Maccabee, how are you today?
I am fine, thank you.
Here it is, Friday, March 17th, when we're recording this show, St. Patrick's Day. I didn't know if I'd get you home or not.
Yeah, well, I guess I'll have to put the green beer off till later.
I was looking at your website today, and you have quite an interesting article. In fact, lots more information than anyone else has on this Iran jet situation. Why don't you bring up our audience up to date and let's talk about that a little bit.
Of course, this was happened a long time ago, and I finally got around to posting material that I've had for like 20 years.
Sounds like this operation.
Well, I always hate to put off till tomorrow what I can do today, but on the other hand, procrastination is the name of the game.
Yeah, I got you.
Anyway, it took a while to do it. I've been working on it over the last month or so, collecting together stuff that I had, and it's events that involved two F-4 Phantom jets flying around over Tehran, Iran. This is while the Shah was still in power. This is before the Ayatollahs took over.
Yeah, I think it was September 19th, 1976.
That's right. And we first found out about it because of a leak. A colonel, Air Force colonel by the name of Evans, visited NICAP in, I guess, in October of 1976, and the guy who was running NICAP at the time, Jack Acuff, he gave Acuff a copy of a formerly, well, I presume was at that time still a confidential, classified confidential document, which was essentially a teletype message from Air Force representatives in Tehran to a number of government agencies in the United States, including the White House, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, and the Army, and the Navy. I'd be the Chief of Naval Operations, and Defense Intelligence Agency, CIA, NSA, all the alphabet soup that you've learned to know and love was all there. And they all got this teletype message about how witnesses, people living in the northeastern area of Tehran, saw some strange lighted object flying over their houses and called up the airport, Mehrabad, Mehrabad Airport in Tehran, which is, I guess, in the northwestern sector of Tehran. And they called the air traffic control people there and said that there's strange thing flying around, and just so happened the radar at this airport was not in operation. It was being repaired at the time, so they didn't have anything on radar, and according to the air traffic control, they basically ignored these phone calls until they've had about four calls at which point the guy who was in charge, whose name was Hossein Peruzzi, he got some binoculars and went to observation deck and looked around, and sure enough, there was this thing flying around over the area, roughly east of him, northeast of him, and he didn't know what to make of it. At the same time, or in the same time frame, now this is all happening between like 10 o'clock at night and midnight, same time, in the same time frame, he was getting some reports from some civilian airliners that were flying over the area. They heard a strange beeping sound, like an emergency beeper, like if some airplane had crashed. This sort of like the black box thing you hear about all the time, except this is a radio transmitter that starts giving out a beacon to search to find a crashed aircraft. So these aircraft that were flying over were hearing this beacon. Well, now Peruzzi, seeing this lighted object, confirming what the people had said, and getting this reports of this crashed or this beacon, decided that something was going on. So he then called up a Air Force general. He called up an Air Force general who lived in Tehran, and general what he had seen, and the general got his own binoculars, went out to his window where he actually was able to look out over the same area. And sure enough, there was this thing out there. So he had made a, I guess, a bold maneuver and called up a Air Force Base, about 100 miles away, known as Shahuroki Air Force Base, and asked to have them scramble a jet. Well, apparently they have jets. They had jets that take off at a moment's notice.
That was back in the Cold War days. I guess everybody did.
Russia was right next, right north of them, and so on. So this jet took off. I talked to a witness, a guy who was a witness to the noise of the jet. It woke him up in the middle of the night, like about 1 o'clock in the morning, and he said that to him it sounded like this jet took off on afterburner. I don't know if they can do that or not, but they can certainly take off pretty fast. So the jet went there, and as it approached Tehran, it could see this bright light over the city. It continued until it detected this bright light on its radar, its own aircraft radar, and followed it at high speed as this thing started to move to stay ahead of the aircraft, of the F-4 jet. The F-4 jet guy got up to about Mach 2, chasing it. He's flying eastward towards the Afghan border, at which point the general ordered him to say turn around before he got to the border. So he did turn around. He got to within about 25 nautical miles of it, according to his radar. Then he turned and headed back towards Tehran. And while he was doing this, the object itself apparently turned zipped past him. He was recorded. They played a recording at a news conference a day or so later. Listen, and you could hear the pilot talking about this thing coming towards him. This is all transcribed.
Yes. Uh-huh.
In my report, so you can read what was happening. This combination of the information here is a combination of the Air Force report itself, plus the interviews of the air traffic controller, plus the newspaper reports that came out at the time. So you can get a pretty good idea of everything that happened from several points of view.
And the thing passed him?
The thing passed the jet going back, and according to the air traffic controller, it was back over Tehran before the jet got there.
Hmm.
So there's some number of minutes between, a couple of minutes between when the jet, when it passed the jet and when the jet actually got back to Tehran. But by this time, the guy was running out of fuel. And so he headed back to his base. The general then had him launch another jet, which took off according to the Air Force report, the second jet took off about 10 minutes after the first one. And this second jet again screamed towards Tehran using its afterburner, and the guy could see the bright light from about 100 miles away. And as he approached it, again it started to speed up. He was chasing the thing, and got to within 25 nautical miles of it when he no longer could get any closer. So it had sped up and matched his speed. Then it started to go into a sort of a turn. He was following it. It gets pretty complicated, and since we don't really have, unfortunately, there were tape recordings from the Air Traffic Control Center, but we don't have access to those. I don't know whether they still exist or not, but apparently they did play a piece of one of them, one of these recordings, for the press a couple of days later. But anyway, according to the Air Force document, this jet was trying to follow the bright light, which is described as being actually a multiplicity of bright lights, changing colors, and so fast it was hard to distinguish what was going on. And the plane got to about 25 nautical miles away, at which point, according to the second pilot, now there's a pilot and a backseater, and each one of these backseater guys running the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot reported that another smaller bright object came out of the main one and started to head towards his aircraft. It says he decided to arm and fire a missile, which was a Sidewinder AIM-9 heat-seeking missile. And he said as soon as he decided to do that, he's about to press the button, I guess, all of his electronics went out.
Wow.
He couldn't even talk to the guy in the back seat. Now, this is one thing to have jamming between the airplane and, say, the ground, but it's another thing to have a system that will shut off your avionics inside the aircraft, and even stuff that's hardwired, like the communications between the pilot and the guy in the back seat. So anyway, the pilot suddenly realized he didn't have any electronics control of his airplane. The airplane can still fly to some extent on hydraulic control. So he turns the airplane away from the object and within seconds regained all his electronics. And this other smaller light, which had come towards him, he said, followed out and inside his turn. He's turning away from it. This object followed him, turning inside his turn, and then headed back towards the main object for a perfect rejoin, unquote. So some weird stuff happened. And then, he said, as he's sort of gone into this holding pattern of looping around this big, bright object, which is now stationary, some smaller light came out of it and went fast, straight down at a fast speed. And it looked to him as if it fell onto the ground. And when the air traffic control guys heard this, they actually launched a ground search for it immediately, calling up the emergency people on the ground. Nothing was ever found down there. But anyway, the second pilot, he had to, his eyes, he was having trouble. He was running out of fuel, so he had to land. He was going to land at the airport in Tehran, Mehrabad Airport, but he couldn't see very well because he had, apparently this thing had been so bright it wiped out his night vision. And so he had to fly or circle the airport a couple of times before he went for a straight-in landing. And during that time, he saw an object, another object flying around, or maybe it was the same one. I'm not absolutely sure from, it's not totally clear as to what's going on. The people who interviewed this pilot, I guess, basically just let him talk and then tried to make some sort of a brief summary of it. They were not what you would call experienced UFO investigators.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll have a problem that pertinent questions were not asked by the, or at least the answers to the pertinent questions certainly weren't available in the information. Fortunately, the interviews of the air traffic controller did provide things like drawings, which people have probably never seen before. Drawings of this object, when it was first seen, he described it as being like a cylinder-shaped thing. He's looking at it from a long distance, but with binoculars. He said he focused the binoculars on aircraft that were on the landing field to make sure that they were in focus. And then he started searching for this object, and sure enough, he found it. And when he first saw it, it was like a cylinder thing with blue lights at each end of the cylinder, a red light going around the center part, sort of circling around this cylinder, and sort of a hazy blue arc of light up above the main body of the cylinder. The people who had called in, one person had been, this is long before he saw it, the person who had called in, he described it as being like a fan with blades drooping down, a ceiling fan with blades drooping down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Peruzzi looked out, he saw it first like a cylinder shape. He said the thing moved around real fast from one place to another. And one of the sightings that he had was like this. He draws a picture, which looks like a starfish. Now, if you think of a starfish, you know, it's got this center part, and it's got these legs that stick out. And sort of, and if it's a living starfish and you pick it up by the center, its legs would sort of droop down. Well, that's sort of what he drew. And that looks very much like one of these ceiling fans.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the fan blades to be hanging down. So anyway,
now do you have that drawing on your website?
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
maps and a drawing by the pilot, one of the pilots drawing what looked like a collection of five blobs of light that were, I guess, rotating at a high speed, and they were various colors and so on. I got some photographs of the Tehran area, and I got a copy of the teletype document that was provided most of the information from the Air Force. So when you read through this, you can get a pretty good idea of what was going on and the frustration, have an idea of the frustration for the ufologist and not really having the totality of the data. key thing here is you have one pilot, one plane after another. I should say the first plane had also experienced this failure of electronics when it got to about 25 miles away. It's as if when the object itself felt threatened by the oncoming aircraft, it turned off the oncoming aircraft. We don't have anything that can do that, so far as I know, other than maybe so-called electromagnetic pulse effects. Those would tend to be cause a huge electromagnetic pulse would have caused interference throughout the whole terrain and then a probably permanent damage on the electronics in the airplane, rather than what you might call self-repairing. This was temporary damage. When the aircraft, I talked to two Westinghouse engineers who studied the, or as you could say, investigated the electronics of these two aircraft after this was all over. And they couldn't find anything wrong. Everything was working normally. So they had no explanation for how these things could fail for a period of seconds and then revert to normalcy afterwards.
You know, it seems to me, Dr. McAbee, over the years I've heard other reports similar to that. Of jets losing their electronics temporarily.
Yes.
And it, like you say, it's something beyond probably what we have.
That's definitely true, beyond what we have, even now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was,
30 years ago.
30 years ago.
Yeah, right. Now, when we talk about that time period, you were pretty active, at least maybe as a little later, in investigations out of New Mexico. You've written quite a few things about things that happened out in New Mexico.
Well, I have written about the what I call the Kirtland landing docks.
Yes. Uh huh.
The Kirtland.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting to.
I ought to give the URL for what I just talked about. The Iran jet case?
Yes. Yeah, we have a link to it, but go ahead and get the URL for radio listeners.
http://, Brumac, B-R-U-M-A-C, .8k.com. So it's brumac.8k.com. That gets you to the front page. If you put a slash and then Iran jet case, I-R-A-N-J-E-T-C-A-C-S-E, all one word, it'll take you to a place where you can download a Word file. I'm going to be putting up a PDF file, too. So there will be a Word and a PDF file there that you can download and read about what happened in over Tehran almost 20 years ago.
Like I say, we have a link to that page as well here by this interview. Let's talk about there were a lot of things happening out around Kirkland back in those days.
Back in 1980 was a very interesting summer.
were you out there physically?
I wasn't there, no.
No, okay.
I did go there in 1985, and I interviewed a man by the name of Richard Doty, whose name has probably come up on your show before.
Why, sure. In fact, I was talking to Richard Doty last week.
Well, I sort of unannounced dropped in on him.
Yeah, and you said that he was rather perturbed.
Yeah.
Which, after meeting him personally, I can understand that.
Anyway, this happened in 1980, in August of 1980, when there were sightings in the area around Kirtland Air Force Base, which is south of Albuquerque. And the one that in particular of particular interest was the one that involved an object that was seen by guards at the Manzano weapons storage area. They reported seeing some light. They didn't think it was a helicopter zipping back and forth and then dropping down behind some mountains that were east of this Manzano weapons storage area. The Manzano weapons storage area was a series of three little mountain peaks, I guess you could say, with a huge double fence around it. And it was patrolled 24/7, and there were holes in the mountains, and inside these holes they had bad stuff. You can imagine what sort of bad stuff. And they saw this thing go down behind the mountains. Now, there was a security guard from the so-called Sandia base there, Sandia National Laboratory,
right,
who was driving around in the area, and he saw this a bright light behind what he described as one of the alarm structures. That's a building out in the in a canyon, a building in a canyon. The building has a fence around it. Inside the fenced area was this bright light. And so he drove towards it in his Jeep, tried to call in for instructions as to what to do. It was only a distance of 3 or 4 miles, probably never had any problems with communication before or after, but at this time, he couldn't communicate with his headquarters. So according to the report, he got out and started to walk towards this object, at which point it took off and went straight up. And it says in the document that this guy was had been a helicopter mechanic, and whatever it wasn't a helicopter. The people in the Manzano storage area, the guards there, reported that some time, not exact time not given, but sometime later they saw this object would have gone downwards first, go back up into the sky. So it's like you have three witnesses at the Manzano storage area and one guy in the canyon where this took place, where this thing landed, so four witnesses to whatever this thing was. And it was a document that was written up by Richard Doty. This is what we got all the information out of. Apparently there were other sightings as well that were referred.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of strange things happening around there. Did you investigate that area where the security guards at night would not go into this particular area?
McCormick Ranch.
Yeah.
And that was where, well, I guess you're probably talking about the testimony of Hawk.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that?
Yes, I have.
Also on my website.
Yeah, and we need to get people to go over and read all of it. That's where I saw it.
That is a real eye-opening testimony, which...
Now, Hawk is name, his code name. I guess people say he's part of the aviary.
Yeah, which doesn't really mean much. And it's a name given to a group of people who probably... some of them might have met one another once or twice in their whole lives. But anyway...
And they just kind of want to have a little discussion board with these nicknames?
I suppose you could put together a discussion board with those nicknames. But some of the people turn up anyway in various places. Hawk has been strangely silent, or maybe it's not so strange, ever since I posted... my report on what he said, and what he said was 20 years ago, 1985 and 86 was when I was interviewing him. I think that was 85 or 80.
What kind of guy was Hawk?
Well,
I mean, you saw him personally.
Oh yeah, I met him. I talked to him on the phone for several hours worth of time, and then met him personally. He was a guy, scientist, been working at. When he retired, he was a branch director or division head or something at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, an advanced physics branch where they were, trying to study how, I guess, advanced aircraft would work. And he apparently had some interactions with the UFO subject long before he went to Wright-Patterson. He retired in, I guess, 1979, 80, 81, somewhere around there. I never would have heard about him if it hadn't been for one Robert Collins, who went to work at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and started asking questions about related to UFO stuff, I guess, in 1983, 84 time frame.
Yeah, now Collins has a bird name, too, I think, on one of those discussion boards. But anyway, he's quite an interesting fellow. He has a new book out.
Right, Exempt from Disclosure, which a lot of... Hawk is mentioned in that book, but in a small piece.
Right. You seem to have gone into great detail of Hawk, and I'm inclined to believe Hawk is for real.
Yep, I think so. He certainly, when he talked to me, he certainly sounded as if this was all stuff that he was personally aware of, and he was saying what comes out in Exempt from Disclosure is certainly consistent with what Hawk was saying back in 1985. So he's essentially maintained a story, and of course you can read in Exempt from Disclosure how Hawk was a driving force essentially behind the UFO cover-up live show that occurred in October 1987. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Was that the one with
That was the one with Falcon and Condor.
Yeah.
But if you read the exemption disclosure book, you'll find out how that sort of essentially came about. And part of it was because Hawk was willing to provide information, although he didn't actually appear in the show. When I talked to him, he told me about things that had happened to him personally, that he was personally aware of. And certainly the most bizarre or shocking event was his story of what happened when he was in Japan as a weather officer.
And you go into great detail about that, and that was quite similar in many ways to what happened in Iran, except this was fatal.
Yes, that was a sad story.
You approached the jet, approached the object, and
well, you know, Hawk said that this thing, this what he was describing, he decided afterwards, apparently was something that happened quite regularly, or at least it happened several times in the past.
And he was the weather officer, if I remember.
He was the weather officer at the time, and this is when he was stationed at the 8th Air Force in the 8th Air Force.
I'm not sure.
Whoever it was, he stationed
In northern Japan, I think, or maybe southern Japan. I don't know. anyway, there was a lot of things happening there.
Anyway, he said that they were picking up on. He was in the radar control center, and he was being given a tour of what was going on there. He had been a weather officer, but not for a long time, and so he was being given a tour of the air traffic control center. And while he was there, the radar people started picking up some object that attracted their attention. Two objects that were flying along at high altitude, and they essentially went over the strait between the north and south islands of Japan. And one of them stayed stationary. So, according to Hawk, he heard the guy who was in charge of the air traffic control center decide to launch a special, what was it?
It had special aircraft design.
Aircraft that had special instrumentation on them.
Uh-huh.
And one of the aircraft couldn't get off the ground, but the other one was able to with his instruments working. And so the guy went up to Hawk, gave a weather report saying that once he broke through cloud cover at whatever it was, 10 or 15,000 feet, then it would be clear sky up above with a full moon or something like that. Anyway, the guy climbed up, and then Hawk could hear the conversation of the pilot. He couldn't hear what the air traffic controllers were saying, he said, but he could hear. They put the pilot on a speaker so that everybody could hear what he was saying. And he gets up through the clouds, and he is being directed towards where this object is, and he says he can see it some miles ahead, and he's told to go into a holding pattern. So that means he's basically going around in circles and keeping his eye on this object. And then the guy who's in charge of the air traffic control center sends a message to Washington, D.C., saying, shall we attack, essentially. And he gets back a message saying yes. So they transmit that to the pilot, and he says he's rolling in, which basically means he's now heading towards the craft. And Hawk said he could hear the voice of the pilot about how he had fired his missiles, I don't know, two or three or four heat-seeking missiles, and the missiles were traveling towards the object, and they were exploding, but they didn't hit the object. They didn't get to the object itself. They exploded before they got there. And then he could hear the pilot saying that this thing had turned on what looked like a big beam, bright light that was gradually rotating around and coming in his direction, that is, the direction to the jet. And the jet started to turn away from the object. The object started to move towards the jet. On the radar, they could see these two radar blips. The jet going into a screaming dive, and the Hawk said he was impressed with the way the pilot's voice went up to this high, controlled falsetto voice, indicating extreme fear, I guess you could say, but a controlled fear. And the pilot was going into a drive to get away, and according to Hawk, they could see these two blips merge. And then the merged blip disappeared. And he said he was on duty for like 48 hours straight, giving weather reports as they
they looked for him.
Searched for any wreckage of this airplane.
And I'm guessing
F 106.
Yeah.
An early F 106, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a search. Don Berliner did a search of trying to locate all those aircraft that had ever been made, the ones that they had serial numbers on. And there are four missing that he couldn't locate. We don't know what that means. But it could be that there is some objective evidence that the plane actually disappeared. In any event, this is what Hawk's story was. And he said that at the time that it happened, he's thinking, well, this is probably some Russian device, you know. It wasn't until years later that he connected it up with the UFO idea. Certainly the Russians probed various country airspaces in their vicinity numerous times. We had that happen a lot over Alaska. And in fact, the fact the Russians probed our airspace over Alaska played a role in sightings in a sighting in 1986 involving Japan Airlines jumbo jet. But at the time in the late 1950s, and for years afterwards, the Russians would send jets over whatever, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, whatever, wherever they wanted to go, just to see what we would do to react. Of course, we did the same with them. His first thought was to put this down as something that the Russians were doing, and that we were trying to shoot down some Russian object. But it wasn't until sometime later, years later, I guess, that he realized that what really had happened did not involve anything that was Russian.
Now, when you called on Hawk personally there in New Mexico in 85 or 86...
I actually saw him in Ohio.
Oh, okay. He was a civilian at that time.
Yes.
But a lot of things happened out there in New Mexico during that time period, and we kind of just brushed against it about McCormick Ranch, but I guess people would go in there and they wouldn't come back.
Well, yeah, that's what Hawk was saying, that he was getting these stories from security guards around various areas. In particular, when he was doing, this was years later, some years after this event in Japan, he was doing geophysical work, which involved placing microphone-type devices in deep inside natural caves that occurred in the National Test Site area north of Las Vegas. This is where they set off atomic bombs underground tests, UGTs. And they were monitoring the effects of the seismic effects of these explosions. So Hawk, at that time, worked for the Cambridge Research Laboratory, the Air Force's Cambridge Research Laboratory, where they have a geophysical laboratory there, and he was on duty, on detail, out to the National Test Site, where he was setting up instruments and, I guess, recording data and so on from these UGTs. And in order to do that, he would have to go into areas where there was a fence, you know, a secure area that was conducted in there by security guards. And at least in one case, these are near areas near S4 and Dreamland and all that, whatever you want to call it. He said that the guards were very squirrely about what was happening. And he said at one time, the guards all wanted to get out before night.
Yeah.
He said that he was working there, and he and another guy were installing stuff, and it was getting dark. So the guard said, okay, basically the guard said, I'm leaving.
Yeah, right.
If you want, I'm getting out. Mm-hmm. And Hawk said, well, he didn't know what to make of that, but in any case, he did his work. And then started to leave. And, of course, it's now getting really dark, and they're traveling along this little road down the mountains. And then finally he said they could see up ahead this lights, which were the headlights of the Jeep that this guard was driving. As he got out through the last gate, he said they walked up the guard who was walking around in circles and smoking one after another, waiting for these people to get out. And I believe he said the guard asked if they had seen anything, and he said, no, we hadn't seen anything. But I don't know if it was this guy or not, but one of those people had indicated that they didn't like to be up there after dark because guards who had stayed up there after dark, some of them didn't come back.
Yeah.
And that was similar to what he got from another guard at this McCormick Ranch.
Yes, uh-huh.
Totally different person in a totally different location, you know, hundreds of miles away. The National Test Site north of Las Vegas versus Albuquerque, New Mexico area. So, apparently, like they say, New Mexico is the land of enchantment, I guess.
Yeah, there are a lot of things, I have a hunch, been going on in Mexico, New Mexico for a long time. The Sandia base always appears to be rather harmless to people, but I have a hunch more things went on there than we thought. So, you've been investigating UFO-related material for some time.
Well, yeah, since the late 60s when I got involved with the original NICAP. There's a new NICAP. It's basically an online National Investigating Committee on Aerial Phenomena that's been started, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. The original one started in 1957 and lasted until about 1980. And it was while I was going to school to get a PhD in physics and going to American University in Washington, D.C., and I heard a lecture at the university in the middle 1960s by two guys who worked at NICAP. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And I said to myself, well, you know, if anybody has the answers to the UFOs, probably these guys do. And it just so happened their office was in Washington, D.C. Well, NICAP was an organization that you could read about in books. It had been around long enough and had been sufficiently public that you could read newspaper stories or, you know, as I said, it appeared in books and so on. So I knew the name NICAP and what it stood for and how they had done research, and I went down to Washington, D.C., assuming to find a great big office there, you know, with lots of secretaries running around and file cabinets and scientists and all sorts of stuff. And
so it was a pretty big operation.
What I assumed it was.
Yeah.
Because, as I said, it was in all the books that, you know, that I had read on the subject. So I went down there, I guess in 1968, to the office, 1536 Connecticut Avenue.
Good address.
But there's absolutely nothing left of what there was back when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a row houses that probably dated back into the 40s or 50s. And 1536 was a doorway leading up to some stairs that led up to a hallway that was lit by a single light bulb at the top. And I knocked on the door, and it opened to a small room, a hallway-like, that was crammed with all sorts of books and stuff piled in, and a little old broken-down secretary lady who was in her, Isabel Davis, must have been in her 60s, I guess, at the time. And all the people you had heard about, like Major Kehoe, who was the guy who started it off, they had basically departed by the time I got there. His desk was there, but I never saw him there. I did meet Kehoe some years later at a UFO conference. But I never saw him at the NICAP office. Never saw Dick Hall at the NICAP office.
Basically, it was just a secretary, huh?
It was basically just a secretary. And these people, well, I think it was Don Berliner and Dick Hall, who had actually spoken at American University some months earlier. They weren't there when I got there, but they said that NICAP needed volunteer help, so I could see why. And one of the first things that Isabel wanted me to do was to write up a one-page fact sheet on UFOs. I still have a copy of it somewhere. Here I was, a new kid on the block, more or less. I had read some books on the subject, and she wanted me to be writing something that she said she gets letters all the time saying, send me all the information you have on UFOs. And of course, she couldn't send all. The correct answer to that would be send a truck.
Yes.
So instead, she wanted to have a one-pager that she could send out, you know, that had a lot of stuff, and she typed it up in small print, and sure enough, that was sent out I don't know how many times. But that's how I got my feet wet in the subject. And then where the rubber meets the road is actually going out and talking to witnesses. The NICAP had these subcommittees spread throughout the United States at the time, and the subcommittees guys were the people who actually did the investigations. And the Washington, D.C. subcommittee was an active organization of, I don't know, a dozen people, I guess. And as a result of that, I went with them on some UFO investigations. It turned out that the people who were witnesses weren't the town drunks. They seemed to be normal, level-headed, respectable, whatever you want. The first witness I investigated was a school teacher, and her husband was an accountant. And she took us along the road where she had seen green lights passing over outside, not far outside of Washington, D.C., and you had to say, well, there's no reason for green lights to be passing overhead in this area where she was driving. So we don't know what it was, an unsolved story, but at least, as I said, at least she had some credibility. A year or so later, I did another investigation. The first one that I ever wrote up involved a elected state official in Mount Jackson, Virginia, and a sighting of an object that he said was hovering over the top of a mountain for quite a distant period of time, and he watched while he was driving home over a distance of a dozen miles or so, and after he got home, he sighted it with respect to nearby wires, and looked at it with binoculars, and was able to draw a picture of it, and essentially my investigation lasted well over a year, because the first time I talked to him, I had him draw a picture, and collected all the information and the maps and all that sort of stuff that he gave me showing where I was. And next time I saw him, a year or so later, I went back, as it were, to take him a copy of the report. But I said, before I do give you the report, could you draw that for me again? And he sat down and he made three attempts. Each attempt was close. The third one was, of course, almost identical to what he had drawn for me a year or so beforehand. And I figured, well, if he was making this all up, he's got one heck of a good memory.
Yeah, that's right. And sort of pretty good evidence.
The thing that was look, he said that the shape was like a rocket. He was looking eastward when the sun was to the west. This was an evening. The sun was behind him, and he's looking to the east, so he's got optimum viewing. It looked to him like there was a football shape or a rocket shape. It wasn't moving any at all. It had not, and what had caught his attention was that he was driving over a period of many minutes. This thing seemed to be maintaining a fixed position several thousand feet above the top of a mountain, which was already 3,000 or 4,000 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got to his house and he looked at it, he brought his family out, they looked at it, everybody looked at it, he looked at it with binoculars. This thing, he said, was stationary. It wasn't moving at all, as far as he could tell. And it had this weird shape. So he looked at it a number of times, and as the sun went down and it got dark, he wasn't able to see it, and it wasn't there the next morning. But that report was one of the credible things to begin my UFO life with, I guess. A lot of people, I gather that a number of people who get interested in this subject are unfortunate, shall we say, to have their first cases turn out to be very weak or zeros. Assume, well, that must be what this all is.
Yeah.
And that result is they either lose interest or they become rabid debunkers.
You've been in this for a while, and that's the reason I brought that out in the conversation, because what's getting your attention these days in the UFO field? What interests you?
Well, I have, over recent years been writing up stuff that I've done in the past. I'm putting things onto my website, like back before Christmas, I put a case on that happened in 1981, which I call the Case of the Flying Christmas Tree. As a photographic case, it involves a number of slide photos, two groups of witnesses a couple of miles apart, seeing this collection of lighted objects moving over the sky. This was happening east of Hartford, Connecticut, in a wooded area, or a rural area, I guess you could say, with sizable distances, half a mile to a mile between houses, typically. Anyway, this series of photographs taken by one of the witnesses shows these clusters of lights, and one of the clusters of lights is a sort of a triangular shape, a collection of red and white dots, which, and the first person to see this, a lady, said when she first saw this thing, it looked like a bunch of white dots to her, and her first thought was that somebody had put a Christmas tree up. She was looking off at a slant angle in a little sort of a hilly area, and she was looking through trees to see these lights when they first appeared. She thought it was kind of strange that they didn't seem to be moving, and her first thought was somebody put up a Christmas tree in that direction. He got a camera, and they took pictures of what appeared to be three objects that went traveling eastward, not directly over, but near their house.
So her husband came out with the camera. I mean, so he was a witness.
All right, he was a witness, and he got a series of, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10 pictures. And this stuff is all on the website. I was a witness at Gulf Breeze, however.
Well, were you?
Remember the Gulf Breeze?
Sure, down in Florida.
There are two basic phases to that. From November 1987 through July of 1988 was the phase of sightings that everybody remembers for their pictures taken by Ed Walters. But after 1988, there were sightings continued into the early 1990s. And in particular, from November 1990 through July of 1992, they were characterized by this reddish light thing that would travel through the sky and then turn white, bright white, flash rapidly. And there were witnesses, people down there who went out virtually every night. this is in Gulf Breeze, Florida, not far from Pensacola. They went out virtually every night except for the bad nights in February and March when it really got cold. But anyway, they went out many nights between November 1990 and July of 1992. They recorded, documented about 170 events during that period of time. It was so frequent that people traveled to Gulf Breeze just to see the Gulf Breeze UFO, and many of them were rewarded. That included some newsmen, news organizations that went there. At first it was a single light or maybe a couple of lights that was moving through the sky, but then in September of 1991, it turned into, they started seeing rings of light appear. And at that point, I decided I would go down there and find out what was going on if I could. And the first, I was told that I got there on a Friday night. I was told that they had a sighting the night before. Didn't have a sighting the night I was there, the first night. But then the second night, sure enough, this thing appeared. And I saw it myself. And made a tape recording of myself describing what I was looking at. There were some other people there, and somebody suddenly yelled, "There it is." And I just happened to be facing towards the city of Gulf Breeze itself, and I just looked up into the sky, not knowing where to look. And I saw this little bright light up there, which had not been there before. This was looking into a hazy sky lit by ground lights. And so they're sort of like, with binoculars, you could look through the haze and see the stars up there.
Do you have that recording still?
I probably have the recording of myself somewhere. It's all recorded in a...
on a cassette?
Script of what I said. So
yeah.
I didn't bother to call the... guys in white coats with butterfly nests to come and take me away because there were 30 other people there. It was videotaped and photographed, and we did a crude triangulation of it. It was several thousand feet away, could well have been 10 or 20 feet in diameter. It was 8 lights forming an octagonal ring. it was pretty weird, and it just sort of seemed to move. I don't know if it was moving upwards or moving horizontally. I didn't see it when it was first observed. It was seconds, a couple of seconds from the first person who yelled, "There it is," to when I saw it. And I was trying to do some get some instruments going at the time when it disappeared, so I didn't actually see it fade out, but it did. It moved a bit and was gone.
No noise, I guess.
No noise. As a matter of fact, that was one of the things I was doing. I had what's called a big ear. Long-distance hearing aid device used to be able to get from Edmunds Corp. Scientific Corporation. Something that would pick up, somebody whispering at a distance of 100 feet or something like that. And I had this pointed at the object, didn't hear a thing.
What do you make of Gulf Breeze? That seems to be a big mystery. They were there.
Part of it that involved Ed and his photos. You got to understand that there were a dozen or so other people who said they saw the same thing, including the county coroner and his wife, claimed they saw the same thing in July of 1988 that Ed had seen in November, December, and January, and February of 1987 and 88.
Yeah, I mean, these things seem to go come and stay for a while, then they go and they never come back. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why.
Priest was sort of like the center of UFO sightings from the spring of '88 on through, oh, the summer, the late spring and early summer of '92. And they still had a few sightings, even had some sightings going up into the middle 90s. I think the last sighting that I know of that Ed reported was 97, I think. And other people were having a few, but you know, it's basically dropped back down to, whereas it had gotten into the hundreds per year for a while. It's, I guess, back down to a few per year, sort of like a normal area.
There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason about these. I guess I would call them hot spots. They happen everywhere.
Yeah, we don't know, or at least I don't know, although I can conjecture. Well, there's been the question of, well, why do we see them at all? If they've got cloaking techniques or something, and why do we see them at all? It may be that they intentionally appear to sort of radicalize the population, you might say, or get us accustomed to their existence. And why they might appear in particular areas at particular times, all we know is that Ed was an abductee, and there were several others in the area at the same time. My conjecture is that we may see them either on purpose or by accident, but they're in an area to, for whatever reason, to interact with some number of human beings in that area. And we
So it is
abduction.
abduction related, in your opinion.
Right. It's a byproduct of abduction.
A good way to phrase it. We only have a couple of minutes left here, but what do you make of
Abduction.
The whole? Yes. I was going to get you're reading my mind.
Well, of course, that's the big hot thing right now. First of all, I would expect that if somebody were to say, yeah, there was a group of people that was taken on board a flying saucer and went to another planet and lived for a while, that they would come back with extremely bizarre stories. On the other hand, all we have are anonymous reports, so far as I know. I mean, there's some evidence that, you know, something like this may have happened. Certainly, Robert Collins, in his book Exempt from Disclosure, builds an argument for the background for this, that their saucers have landed, there have been direct interactions with human beings, and so on, and therefore it's possible that they have taken some group of people elsewhere. So I would expect if it were true, that things would be pretty bizarre. And if you read through the Serpo stuff, yeah, things are bizarre, but there are also things which are technically questionable or just plain wrong with the reports. I was one of the first people to criticize the reports for saying things that sort of don't obey astronomical laws. They claim that this planet is around one of the stars of Zeta Reticuli, although now we've heard that there's another planet, Alpha Centauri, involved. But the claim that the original Serpo or whatever was at around one of the stars of Zeta Reticuli, and those two stars are 6/10 of a light year apart or something, huge distance. And
They wouldn't look like what he described.
well, they talk about orbiting two suns, and there's no way you could do that. Based on what they're talking about, an orbital period, a year of,
Well, perhaps.
I don't know, I forget all the technical details, but the
Right.
point is that it doesn't seem to check out.
Well, perhaps they changed the names and places to protect the innocent.
The names and places of the planets, you mean?
Yes. In other words, maybe it is really Alpha Centauri.
Well, I don't know. The point is that, as I said when I public posted my first announcement, what we need is more information. We still need more information. Apparently, the original anonymous hasn't said anything since December 21st, and now there have been more recent anonymous sources. But anonymous could be one person, could be three people, could be a science fiction writer who was, you know, trying to get well known even before he publishes his first book.
Well, and then there is some evidence, you know, that there was a science fiction writer worked for the CIA that wrote something similar to that.
Well, I'm not betting my life on Serpo.
It's interesting, interesting story anyway. You hear any other rumblings about the existence of extraterrestrials somewhere around here on Earth?
No, aside from
The usual.
the continual flow of sightings, I guess. I was just listening to radio recordings made 10 years ago, 95 and 96, by pilots in Cleveland, Ohio, and near Boston and New York. Pilot sightings that were tape recorded at the air traffic control centers and available for, you know, discussion. Unfortunately, I don't know whether how much investigation has been done, but you know, the Mexico case that made world wide interest 2 years ago.
Yeah, I remember that. The
We
infrared deal.
got a huge report on that on my website also, and in that case, that one became super popular, I guess you could say, because of the forward-looking infrared images that appeared to be, to the people at the time, it appeared to be distant objects traveling along with them. And my analysis seems to show that these objects may have been distant, all right, may have been stationary on the ground. But what alerted them to even be doing a search was an initial radar target. They had picked up a strange radar target. I say it didn't seem strange to them at first. They thought they were following a drug runner, some guy who had just taken off from a small airfield in the Yucatan Peninsula. This was a two-engine, it's a prop aircraft, capable of a couple hundred miles an hour flight speed, a surveillance aircraft that was flying over the Yucatan Peninsula, essentially patrolling for drug runners, contraband aircraft that would be taking off from airfields that were dug into the forest in the Yucatan. And so when they first got this radar target, that's what they thought they had. And so they started chasing it. They turned to follow this thing. And it was heading towards the northwest. They caught up to within 2 miles of it, and then they couldn't get any closer, according to their radar. But the strange thing was, they couldn't see it. Now, any aircraft capable of a couple of hundred miles an hour flight is going to be some 10 or 20 feet in size, in 2 dimensions, probably, you know, along its flight and transverse-wise, the wings.
So you would be able to see it.
Everything we have that flies emits heat. Well, they turned on their forward-looking infrared, which detects hot objects, and they couldn't see anything with the infrared. They did an infrared search. They couldn't find anything that would correlate with this radar target that was ahead of them. And they followed it for about 10 minutes without being able to see a thing either visually or on their infrared. And yet, according to the radar, it was about 2 miles away. That is pretty strange. Then they were running out of fuel, so they're flying towards the northwest. To get back home, they have to make a right turn, so they make a rather sharp right turn to head east. This object kept going to the northwest and actually sped up, according to what I calculated based on the radar data and the position of the airplane itself as a function of time. That's kind of strange, too. If this had been a drug runner somehow managing to mask his airplane, make it invisible and cold so that it's not a hot spot, you would think that if he had the capability of traveling faster than the surveillance aircraft,
He would have done it.
he would have stepped on the pedal. He would have put the pedal to the metal immediately.
Right.
Instead, he just sort of leads them on at their speed, 230 miles an hour, roughly, until they turn away from him. And then he steps it up to 400 or 400 or 500 miles an hour. So it made no sense from the point of view of suggesting this was an airplane. And of course, one of the first things the surveillance aircraft did when they picked it up on radar was they called ground radar. Have you got anything? And they said, you're the only aircraft in the area. There was something weird that happened at that point. And I declare that as a radar UFO.
Well, that's a good way for us to end the show. We'll be checking your website regularly. You're updating it quite often now.
Yes. and you can check to see what happened with the year of the UFO.
Okay.
That's a good history right there.
Certainly sounds like it. And Dr. Maccabee, appreciated.
I'm happy to be here, and thanks for the invitation.
And we'll be talking again soon.